You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 12th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Apuzzo, co-author of Enemies Within, New York PD's Secret Spying Unit, and Bin Laden's Final Plot versus America. He is one of the two journalists who did a 2012 Pulitzer Prize-winning series on the NYPD spying. Also on the program today, Vladimir Putin picks up pen. NSA sharing unminimized data collected by their surveillance programs with the Israelis, and the Israelis are not supposed to look at the stuff from Americans. Winkety wink wink. Also on the program today, we'll get to that Kasich story in Ohio and the debt ceiling crisis still looming. Republicans still enthralled by the notion of defunding Obamacare may actually reverse the sequester by mistake. One can only hope. All that and more on the program today, the deficit at an all-time low. Later in the program, your phone calls at 646-257-3920. Also, of course, as we do every day, we'll be taking your IMs later in the program. Just a little bit of housekeeping. No word yet on the app. We're anticipating approval within hours, if not days. And we will let you know as soon as that happens. And, of course, then we will let you know when it's going to be available. Right now, we're anticipating next week. But all good things come to those who wait. This is a heartwarming story. Yesterday, Pastor Terry Jones, you all recall this man of God, and his associate pastor, Marvin Sapp Jr., were arrested on felony charges as they drove a pickup towing a large barbecue-style grill filled with the Quran and soaked in kerosene as a way of commemorating 9/11. He, of course, Jones, is a pastor of a small evangelical Christian church known for burning Qurans in 2010, or at least attempting to. Then he called it off. His congregation then did burn the Quran in March of 2011. Not sure why March of 2011, but... And last year, he was involved in doing some PR marketing for an anti-Muslim film. Terry Jones has been arrested. I'm not exactly sure what the specific charge is. Apparently, it's not a safe thing to do, to haul around a huge trailer full of kerosene-soaked anything.
But it's a wonderful day to spend the day at a park. And now Terry Jones will be spending it in jail. I'm glad to see. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Apuzzo, author of Enemies Within.
This song is called The Man in Black. Well, you wonder why I always dress in black. Why you never see bright colors on my back. And why does my appearance always have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down. Living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. And I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but still is there because he's a victim of the times.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Matt Apuzzo. He is a co-author of the book Enemies Within, which he co-authored, of course, with Adam Goldman, and also the journalists, or the, I guess, the pair of journalists won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize, excuse me, for their series on the NYPD spying. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
We got him. I'm sorry, Matt. We got a little bit of a sound. Can you go up a little more?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. All right. Just give us 1 second because we're having just a little bit of trouble hearing you.
Sure.
Hold on for 1 second. All right. There we are. Okay, Matt. Thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. No. Yeah. No problem. Of course.
So let's start. I want to start at the beginning on how the this intel regime with the new New York Police Department started. Just give us some background there and who came in to lead it.
Sure. Well, after 9/11, like every story of the past decade begins with 9/11, the NYPD decided that it could not rely solely on the federal government to keep the city safe. And so the new police commissioner, Ray Kelly, went and recruited a man named David Cohen, who had just relatively recently retired from the CIA. He had become the nation's top spy. And he said, look, you know, we need a robust intelligence operation at the NYPD. And then Cohen took over the intelligence division and actually called back to his old friends in Langley and said, you know, I would love if you could send me an active duty CIA guy here to be like my personal liaison to the agency. So then the CIA sent this active duty CIA officer to New York, where he had an office at the police department. And
this
an office
is Sanchez.
At the CIA. Yeah, this is Larry Sanchez. And together they built these programs that you know, used plainclothes detectives to hang out in Muslim neighborhoods and eavesdrop on conversations. They would make a note of what the ethnicity of the owner, what the ethnicity of the clientele was, what they were talking about, what the mood was. Were they angry about drone strikes overseas? Were they watching Al Jazeera? Were they talking about the State of the Union address? How were they dressed? Were they dressed in sort of more traditionally conservative Islamic clothing? Were they carrying Qurans? Where did they, you know, did they talk about where they prayed? These all went into files, and these files, which we've obtained, are pretty striking. I mean, they're one photograph after another, after another, after another of all these, minority-owned businesses, and cataloged by ethnicities, and cataloged, by where they pray, what strand of Islam they follow. So it's not like anything that exists anywhere else in American policing.
I've had this question since your series came out. There is supposedly a firewall, and statutorily the CIA cannot spy on Americans. Larry Sanchez is getting a paycheck from the CIA and the New York Police Department simultaneously. Is that right?
No, he was actually in his money came 100% from the CIA for the first 2 years, and then he took a unpaid leave of absence from CIA, was still technically CIA, but was on leave of absence, the next 2 years he was on NYPD payroll until finally somebody said, you know, hey, look, you can't keep wearing these two hats. You need to decide. And so he left the CIA and after 4 years and became the NYPD's assistant commissioner for intelligence.
Now, who said that? I mean, because it seems to me, I mean, in the course of your reporting, did you get any indication as to the legality of that situation? I mean, I guess, you know, I understand you're obviously not a prosecutor, but that's...
No, sure. It's certainly murky, and it's never been done before. And after we brought it to light for the Associated Press, an inspector general investigation began, this sort of internal review at the CIA. And what they found was they didn't break any laws, but that at times, you know, lines had been crossed, and that there wasn't the traditional kind of oversight and review of this unique relationship, and that they'd actually sent Larry to New York without having it reviewed and vetted by lawyers, without having a clear memorandum of understanding of what he could and he couldn't do. And so that led to, you know, what we've seen, where this guy who's active duty CIA, getting paid by CIA, is actually telling police officers how to investigate, how to gather intelligence in New York City.
And is any of, and does the flow of information go the other way? In other words, you know, you've got this CIA liaison who's there 100% paid by the CIA. At that time, does any of the information that the NYPD gathers, does it go the opposite direction?
That's a great question, right? Because, you know, the CIA is not supposed to collect intelligence for its own files from Americans. It doesn't look like from official channels that that happened, but, you know, it certainly looks like, you know, we've been able to identify some spots, you know, where informally information was passed, you know, kind of personal relationship. You know, it's a great question, and you know, this is what happens. We're in uncharted waters in terms of these kind of relationships. After our stories broke, they had replaced Sanchez with a new CIA officer, one of the most senior officers in the agency. After our stories broke, and people in Congress were like, "Hey, we didn't even know about this relationship." The CIA pulled their guy out of the NYPD.
Wow. Well, I mean, I have to say it stretches the imagination to believe that information just went one direction in terms of advice. And I guy takes a leave of absence from the CIA. It's hard to say he's still not CIA in my estimation. But be that as it may, I mean, I guess that's, I mean, well, let me ask you this. I mean, before we go any further, has there been any attempt by Congress or by, I guess, maybe the New York City Council or any inspector in generals who have really sort of dug into this relationship or have continued to do so? Or do they just say, like, let's just make it look better and, you know, turn the page?
Well, it's interesting because the Homeland Security Department, Congress, the Justice Department, and the White House all fund the NYPD's Intelligence Division, but they all independently say, well, we have no idea. We have no idea what they're doing. And it's not our job to know. This is a municipal police department. They know. So even though we're talking about, you know, billions of dollars to the NYPD, nobody in Washington is saying, hey, where's the money going? Do we agree with these programs? The White House actually pays for the surveillance cars and the video equipment used for their some of their operations. And, you know, so while on the one hand they're out, you know, talking about outreach and, you know, we're going to have a better relationship with Muslims. On the other hand, they're funding, you know, a spying operation, the likes of which no police department has ever seen. Further, we don't have, there's almost no oversight from the city council, which until our stories came out, had no idea there was something called the demographics unit or that, you know, they have labeled entire mosques as terrorist organizations so that they can conduct surveillance inside the mosque. So it's not like there's anybody outside the NYPD actually, you know, trying to force some oversight.
So when we say black budgets, I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? I mean, no pun intended here. I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? I mean, because this money just
well, it's a black. it's a black budget, not like the CIA is a black budget where it's like classified. This is a black budget because the city council has decided that they're not, you know, they're not interested or they're not equipped. Some of them say, hey, we're not equipped to really do that kind of oversight.
All right. Well, let's talk about the TEI, the Terrorism Enterprise Investigation, which was one of the big pieces that came out of your reporting for the book, as opposed to what you had revealed in your series for the AP. Tell us how that was developed and how they got around or how they were able to sort of revisit the handshoe case.
Sure.
And tell us about the handshoe case as well.
Yeah, so 1960s and 1970s, the NYPD was conducting intelligence gathering in the what started as we're going to look at radicals, you know, to look for radical, you know, leftist terrorists. But it sort of grew, right? And pretty soon they were infiltrating anti-war groups and peace advocates, civil rights groups. They had an NYPD black desk to investigate black issues. And this all came to a head in the 70s. There was a class action lawsuit known as the Handschuh case. And after about 10 years of litigation, it resulted in an agreement, a federal binding agreement, that the NYPD would only investigate First Amendment protected activities if there was actual evidence of a crime that was committed or is being committed. After 9/11, NYPD goes to court and says, "Hey, these rules is antiquated rules. This is we can't fight terrorism this way. We need to be able to open an investigation before there is evidence of a crime." Because if we wait for there to be evidence of crime, we've waited too late, and pretty soon you're going to have, you know, more buildings crumbling in Lower Manhattan. The judge agreed, and so we lowered the standards. So now you can actually start your investigation in New York, you know, where there are the possibility of a crime being committed. So, you know, think about how broad that is. I mean, where in New York is there not, or where in any city, where in any town, is there not the possibility of a criminal activity going on? And so one of the things they did was they labeled mosques as terrorism and are suspected terrorism enterprises. And if the whole mosque is a terrorism enterprise, then as part of your investigation, then everybody who goes there can be subject to the investigation. So anybody who shows up to pray, you can put their license plate in police files. Anybody who says something, whatever the sermon is, it's fair game because the whole mosque is part of the terrorism enterprise. And these investigations stretched on for years and years and years. And it's 2013, and we have yet to see a single case made against a mosque as a terrorism organization by the NYPD.
Are they still allowed to do this? I mean, I've read about this for the past week over and over again, and just when you're saying it, it's so chilling. Is this still ongoing?
Yeah, you know, the NYPD has said nothing has changed, that they're going to do everything they can do legally to protect the city. And, you know, we don't actually even assert this is illegal. I mean, for us, it's actually much more fascinating a story about what we have made legal or what we have made policy in the United States since 9/11. I mean, it's the debate you're seeing now playing out with the NSA down here in Washington, where people are talking about, well, do we want to be doing this? It is much less of a question of is it legal. Everybody knows we passed the Patriot Act. Everybody knows we, you know, gave the NSA additional wiretapping authorities in 06. Everybody knows the NYPD went and got the handshoe rules changed in 2003. The question, I guess, is when you give government this power without public disclosure, how do we know what's being done? How do we, you know, how do we give our informed consent to the government to allow them to do something if we don't know what we're giving up, we don't know what we're getting in return?
Yeah, now does this terrorism enterprise, system or designation, did this justify the NYPD leaving town and going and spying on universities or I think you guys had a story, if I recall, about a landlord who went into his apartment and found like a surveillance thing and called up the police and said, "Hey, there's something going on here," and it turns out it was. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, we have it. This is a scene in the book. It's New Brunswick, New Jersey, you know, and it's not obviously inside the New York Police Department's jurisdiction. And there was a safe house, an NYPD safe house that was being used by undercover officers who were keeping tabs on the Muslim Student Association at Rutgers. And, you know, they have police files, they have NYPD equipment, radios, pictures, you know, sort of terrorist literature, surveillance pictures, all this stuff up in the apartment. And then they, you know, they leave it there. This was not a manned safe house. But it's all just sitting there. So one day the apartment, the landlord comes around to do the annual inspection and, unlocks the door, walks in, and is like, oh my God, it's a terrorist cell. I have a terrorist cell in my back, in my apartment building. And he calls 911 and the local cops and the FBI come like screaming down the highway to this apartment. And lo and behold, oh, it's an NYPD spying operation that nobody told us about. It was being done outside their jurisdiction. But you know what? The NYPD says we're going to go anywhere in the country we want to do investigations.
Yeah, how is – under what legal framework – I mean, are they allowed to do that jurisdictionally? Because I guess they're not making a case, right? They're just investigating.
They say that most of what they do, they're not doing as official police work. They're going as citizens. It's really odd. I mean, that'll get tested if, God forbid, you know, something happens to one of these guys. And, you know, well, are they covered by workman's comp? I mean, or what are they covered? If they were there just there as private citizens, what were they doing? So it's completely weird. And when, what we try to do in Enemies Within is we try to say, let's take a real look at the most serious Al-Qaeda plot operating inside the United States.
This is the Zazi subway system.
Yep, the Najd, right. It's just three guys from Queens who decide they're gonna join up and fight with the Taliban. And they fly out to Pakistan, and turns out they got swooped up into Al-Qaeda and turned into suicide bombers and pointed back at New York. They build a bomb, and they decide they're going to blow up the New York City subway system. And they had the means to do it. So our book focuses on this frantic 48-hour chase in New York City on the 8-year anniversary of 9/11 to try to stop this bombing. And through that lens, through that story, which is this crazy action story, through that story we actually look at, well, what works and what doesn't in counterterrorism. And that's what we're trying to get across.
And the point is that in the course of that investigation, in the course of foiling that plot, none of the tools that seem to be employed by the NYPD intelligence unit, or demographics unit, or whatever they're calling it now, were actually used. Right? I mean, it's arguable as to whether or not it hindered the investigation.
Right. Well, you know, what we know is that the NYPD was inside Zazi's mosque. They had turned his imam into a cooperative witness. They had infiltrated the student group, the Muslim Student Association, that one of his co-conspirators was a member of. They had, you know, built files on all of the businesses in his neighborhood, even the YMCA down the street where, you know, some Afghani men worked out at the gym. They had built files on they have a file on the actual travel agency where he bought his ticket to Pakistan. So all of this stuff goes in, all of this stuff about people who have no connection to terrorism whatsoever go into police files. But in the end, they didn't spot the actual terrorist.
And what about in terms of, did they almost tip off? I mean, so they were just coincidentally in these locations without any awareness that this was going on under their nose, essentially.
Correct.
And did they, was there the slight implication that they may have in some way almost foiled the apprehension of these guys?
You know, there was some coverage to that regard after this case broke in the media. But you know what? Our book does not point the finger at the NYPD for that. You know, this was a fast-moving case. What happened is, you know, it's a pretty dramatic moment in the book, so I don't want to give too much away, where the whole thing basically nearly comes crashing down. And a lot of FBI guys were blaming the NYPD for that. But our book actually, you know, makes the point that that's kind of unfair. I mean, you know, the NYPD raised its hand and said, hey, we did this, you know, we got to move forward. These things happen in investigations.
What of the claims that there have been 14 plots foiled by this apparatus? In other words, I mean, if the argument is people should be aware in the book, that people should be aware of what lengths we've gone to, just how much we are sort of, watering down the 14th Amendment,
right,
watering down the First Amendment. Even if the issue wasn't, hey, this is, you know, we have some constitutional questions here, but what about efficacy? I mean, is there any indication from your reporting that this has actually kept New York safer in any way?
Well, you know, it's hard to have the discussion because the NYPD keeps moving the bar. So the NYPD and Bloomberg and their allies would say, you know, we've thwarted 14 terrorist attacks. That is just demonstrably false. So now ProPublica did a great story about going through all of these plots and showing, nope, that's not an NYPD plot. Nope, that's not an NYPD plot. That wasn't even a plot. But what they've now said is there were 16 plots. Now the number's up to 16. There's 16 plots up against the city since 9/11, and none of them have been successful, either because of the federal government or the NYPD or good luck. And that's probably true. I mean, that's as close to true as I think they've come. But I mean, that doesn't necessarily speak to the efficacy that you're asking about. I mean, Faisal Shahzad drove a Pathfinder into Times Square filled with explosives, and the only reason it didn't blow up is he was a bad bomb maker. That's not foiling an attack. That's just a dumb bomb maker. Had that gone off, you know, I think there would have been real questions, or there should have been real questions asked about, you know, well, where was the NYPD on this? Where were, you know, there's 10 million cameras in Times Square. They didn't see this guy drive in. What happened?
Is it your sense through your reporting that the resources that have been dedicated to these sort of more, I guess, you know, sexy clandestine operations has in some way taken the NYPD's eye off the ball? In other words, I mean, you know, there's billions of dollars going into building up these huge files on what appears to be virtually every Muslim in the city. Maybe that money might be spent more efficiently in other areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger issue is, I mean, that's an issue for people in government and for voters to decide, frankly. The bigger issue is that this infrastructure only ratchets one way, right? So the justification for what we're doing here is we haven't been attacked yet. You know, so we know it must be working because we haven't been attacked. I mean, there's a logical flaw in that. Ipso, I mean, post hoc ergo propter hoc, like after, therefore, because of, right? So, but setting that aside, if you're going to say, well, we haven't been attacked yet, so we know this is working, I mean, then when God forbid we're attacked again, are we going to say, well, you know, that didn't work, we just stop doing that? No, they're just going to say, oh, well, we need to do more, right? We just need to do even more. So that's the issue. So if we don't have conversations about this topic, and we don't have conversations about what we're giving up and what we're getting in return, then, you know, there's never ability for the public to weigh in and check the authority.
Talk about, in the course of your reporting, did you find that, I want to just stay on this too, because there was one point that really struck out at me too, was the level of attention that was given to the stories about, there were some sort of like city schools that were infiltrated by the NYPD, Muslim groups, student groups in city schools. And then when the story that got a lot of the attention was sort of the Rutgers story, or that I can't remember what the other, college was, but it was an Ivy League school. There seemed to be more attention paid to the Ivy League infiltrations than I think it was like City College. What do you see the implications of that?
Look, there's a huge class and political power issue here, right? I mean, when we were writing about infiltration of of student groups at City College in New York, nobody cared. But when we said the NYPD also goes onto the Muslim Student Association websites at Princeton and Columbia and Yale and puts that information in police files, even though that is much less intrusive than what they were doing at CCNY or CUNY schools, then suddenly it was like, oh my God, you get presence in the university writing letters. And so there's as much a class issue as there is a, you know, religious issue here. And it's about entrenched political power too, right?
That's almost metaphorical for the whole problem, right? I mean, because the Muslim community does not have the political juice of, let's say, the Jewish community in New York,
the Hispanic or Black communities, right?
Yes, I mean, however you want to slice or dice it, I mean, these questions are just not being taken as seriously.
Right. I mean, you know, nobody that we know of is suggesting let's put undercover officers inside the Archdiocese of New York City's churches because, you know, we want to root out pedophile priests, you know, and there would be blowback on that politically. The Irish and the Italian communities, you know, the Catholic communities in New York have had a long time to, you know, generations to mature and become politically mature entities in the city in a way we just haven't seen from the Muslim community yet. And part of it is there is no Muslim community. I mean, it's, you know, 700,000 to 1 million people, but there are Pakistanis, there are Bangladeshis, there are Iranians. You know, I mean, they don't all, just because they have a shared religion doesn't mean they want to share a voice, that they have a shared views, that they have the same issues.
Indeed. And what did you guys find in terms of this unit's work relative to protesters? I mean, like around Occupy, did you dig into if this apparatus was also used in the context of like the Zuccotti Park? And
well, what we know, let's say, here's my favorite example on this, and we talk about this in the book, is so you guys probably remember the Times Square recruiting station bomber, right? A guy in a hoodie rides his bike up to in the middle, you know, at 3 a.m, rides his bike up and plants a pipe bomb in front of the recruiting center, and it blows the glass out of the window. Nobody's hurt, but it's, you know, it scares everybody to death. So what happened is a couple weeks after that, the NYPD opened an investigation into this guy named Dennis Burke, who is left-wing protester. He rides his bike in these critical mass protests. He's known to hang out with protesters, people who have protested at, you know, embassies. He's a liberal protester, and he has a rap sheet, but it's minor stuff, you know, misdemeanors and whatnot. So they say, we're going to open this investigation into Dennis Burke for possibly blowing up this pipe bomb. And the whole case hinges on the fact that at one point Burke ran a blog, and on that blog he linked, or somebody linked, to a Fox News article about the bombing. And that would suggest that maybe he knew that it was going to happen in advance. So based on that, they assign an undercover to try to infiltrate these protest groups that he's associated with.
Wait a second. I have to tease that out. The fact that he linked to an article that was written after it suggested that he
Correct.
Knew about it beforehand?
Right. Three hours after the bombing, there was a story on Fox News about it. There's a story on all the news stations. But the link... the link to the Fox News article was posted on the blog 3 hours after the bombing. And so they're saying, well, that suggests he had earlier inside knowledge.
He was up at 4 in the morning. He was up at 7 a.m. linking on his blog.
Yep.
And also,
as far as I can tell,
it implicates Fox.
Hey, now you're really going to get in trouble.
I'm thinking like the NYPD. All right, go.
And so they actually they put it undercover and they send him into these groups. Times Up New York, Critical Mass, Friends of Brad Will. These are protest organizations, liberal groups, and the NYPD actually flies an undercover out to to New Orleans to be part of what was called the People's Summit. And it was this anti-globalization summit, but I mean, it had groups that were pro-Palestinian rights organizations. They had people there who were trying to organize labor, doing labor organization for nannies, you know, people like that. And these guys ended up in police files because they were at this conference.
Wow.
And the whole reason they were at the conference is because they were trying to investigate these other liberal groups. And the whole reason they were investigating the other liberal groups is because of Chris Burke, of Dennis Burke. And the whole reason they're investigating Dennis Burke is because of this Fox News story. So, I mean, it just shows you how broadly this gets interpreted.
Now, how is it that you guys, I mean, you guys are D.C. reporters. Were you on the New York City beat? I mean, how did you end up sort of getting keyed into this case?
Well, we're on the investigative team here, and our sort of focus at the time was mostly national security stuff. So because of the CIA overlap, you know, we basically stumbled into this, ended up spending about 2 years on it. And the book is actually, you know, footnoted extensively. You know, I mean, it's just, I don't know, we have 50 pages of footnotes or something like that. And we've got a bunch of their internal documents. So we posted them up on the web, enemieswithinbook.com. You can go there. You can read the documents as you're reading the book. You know, NYPD says we're making this all up. You read the documents, you decide.
And let me just ask you about that. I mean, obviously you can't reveal your sources, but, I mean, where did you get this stuff? Well, I don't know if you can even say this, but did the flow of information, were the people who were responding to this, was it people who were part of the national security apparatus or from the city? In other words,
well, both. I mean, we had people who were very helpful to us inside the NYPD, who provided us a number of people who provided us their documents, and we had obviously people who had, you know, were sort of become aware of what was going on there at the CIA and the NYPD. I mean, and the FBI. And you know, what we're really proud of in this book is that there's not a lot of anonymous sources. I mean, we really press people to go on the record. So, you know, one of the people you'll meet is the NYPD lieutenant who actually ran the demographics unit, and we talk about his views on this and how they transformed over the years.
And I mean, is that Hector Berdicia?
Berdicia, yeah.
And was your sense that there was a significant amount of dissent in the context of the NYPD to the extent that they knew what was going on?
I think there was just growing skepticism. So a worry like, well, is this really the best way? I mean, a lot of the analysts we talked to were just like, you know, why don't we ever make cases? Why don't we ever catch people? You know, if we're collecting all this information and all these people and we say it's helping, like, well, what are we really doing? And I think there was some skepticism in the ranks. It wasn't, you know, there was one analyst we talked to who said, you know, we should be working to make our jobs, you know, obsolete. And they kind of like jumped on their throat, like, well, you know, our job will never be obsolete. You know, there will always be a threat. And so, I mean, it's just the truth is New York, because of the good work that the NYPD and the FBI and the CIA have done, New York and this country are a lot safer. And saying that doesn't mean that we're not taking the threat seriously and that, you know, we don't need to be vigilant. It just means like, hey, we're safer. We should be able to, it's been 12 years. We should be able to have an intelligent conversation about how we want to do these things.
And lastly, as we go forward, who should we, if we're interested in some type of oversight of what's going on within this segment of the NYPD, are you aware of any politicians in Washington or in New York or any agencies? I mean, I guess theoretically the FBI could have looked into this from a civil rights violation standpoint.
Right.
Is anybody, I mean, is there a sense, do you have a sense that as you start to move on to other stories, I imagine, that there are people who are going to sort of pick up the ball where you guys left off and use this information?
Well, I mean, you know, look, one of the big champions for this at the New York City Council is a councilman named Brad Lander. And, you know, after our stories came out, he was one of the big proponents at the NYPD needed an inspector general. And the council actually got together and put in an inspector general, somebody from the outside to do some oversight, and that's going to happen now. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's going to be a new mayor. Who knows if there'll be a new police chief. You know, we'll see. We'll see what happens. You know, this is something that's ongoing now, and we'll know more as it unfolds.
Matt Apuzzo, the book is Enemies Within, NYPD Secret Spying Unit, and Bin Laden's Final Plot Versus America. Thanks so much for your time today. We're going to link to that book, obviously, at majority.fm. Really appreciate your taking the time.
Super. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We had a tiny little audio snafu up front. Then it just went away. We're going to head into the better half of the program, wherein we'll do a random rush. We may turn on the AC because it's a little bit warm in here. We will also talk about this latest NSA revelations. More keep coming from these Edward Snowden documents. Obviously, it's not as highlighted in the news these days because of, you know, writing editorials is garnering all the attention. We'll also talk about the new data on the income gains of the 1%. I think, you know, at the very least, and it appears now de Blasio, I guess they still have a couple of thousand absentee ballots extant, but it appears now that he's going to get over 40%. Say qualified.
Did you see what a major figure in Bill Thompson's
campaign? Bill Thompson's campaign manager said it was a decisive victory.
Yeah.
And
that's just for everybody who might not know, that's the guy who's in second place to de Blasio.
And again, you know, without speaking to, you know, what de Blasio will or will not do, we don't know. And, you know, watchwords here are always hope springs eternal, but it's better to be what is it? Optimistic and pessimistic?
Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of
the
will.
Yeah, there you go. And but at the very least, it is an indication of the sensibility of where, at the very least, New York is. There is a heightened sense of that there is a problem with issues of economic inequality, with issues of services for the poor in this city, with the crushing of the middle class. And to that extent, you know, that awareness and the fact that New Yorkers acted upon it is an encouraging sign. And I'm not convinced, you know, we're a couple days away from the two-year anniversary of Occupy. And I'm not convinced that that wasn't that still isn't having those months in particular didn't change the perspective of New Yorkers, or at least make them more aware and more conscious of the fact that it needs to be addressed. All right,
there have been some we are the 99% chance at the de Blasio events.
Really?
Which speaks directly to what you're saying, yeah.
There you go. I knew it.
I was right.
6'4".
That's Sam.
I
called it.
That's what I'm going to be doing after the show today. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, you can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. If you buy crap on Amazon, buy it through our link. You go to majority.fm. On the homepage, scroll down, click on the link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon junk through it. You will see no difference whatsoever. You will be so unaware of it, you're not even sure that it's happening. But we get a kickback, and every little bit helps. Some of our sound issues were just a function of trying to upgrade our phone system and then finding out that one of the, I don't know if it's the sound card on our computer or just the socket or whatever, was defaulted. And we found that out after I basically upended the entire infrastructure of our office. and realized, no, it's not a bad cable. It's actually a bad source. So there's a little... There's a little aphorism for you, I guess. Always look to the source first and then follow the cable. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. You can IM me at Majority FM. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. See you in a minute.